Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Adam White, who joins us again on a Wednesday morning. Good morning to you, Whitey.
Good morning. Yeah, an exciting time for domestic cricket here in the country with the focus going on to the Big Bash. Obviously, we've had six rounds of the Sheffield Shield season, but it's the Big Bash that's captured the imagination of so many people and will continue to be the case this summer, even just the talk around the big news in the Big Bash yesterday.
What's the big news in the Big Bash yesterday?
How they will determine who will bat and who will bowl.
Yes, stand by for that. I want to bring that up with Adam Ramanauskas. No Sharon McMahon today. She's got the Melbourne Stars launch. Of course, as a very important board member and director of the Melbourne Stars, she can't be with us this morning. So not a Sherelle Wednesday today, but Adam Ramanauskas, the manager to the Stars, is with us on a Wednesday. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned too with that, Whitey. The terminology concerns me already. I don't mind the concept. Terminology I do have a big problem with.
Right, stand by. Just for those playing at home, Whitey, they haven't come across the big news of the Big Bash yesterday. Can you please explain it?
They will spin a bat or flip a bat to determine who will bat and who will bowl.
Old school backyard activity. Roofs or flats?
Well, this is the thing.
Well, this is exactly.
What do you mean this is the thing?
Well, they were using the terminology hills.
Who was using that?
Yes.
Who?
It's everywhere.
Sackable.
Look at Scotty's column today.
Scotty Gullen?
Yeah.
What did he say?
A couple of players are using the terminology of hills.
They're unacceptable.
Hills, what's that?
Well, I believe that what has emerged from this new initiative is that depending on what state you live in, there seems to be a different terminology.
Oh, this is like the potato cake scallop type situation,
yeah.
Is it?
Palmy Palmer situation.
Don't start that.
So I was a little bit... But even what Half just said is not what we said growing up either.
What? Roofs and flats?
Yeah.
Yeah,
what did you say?
I was roofs and flats.
Well, firstly, wouldn't it be roofs, not roofs?
Well, yeah, if you want to be particular and pedantic about it. Yeah, but we're kids, so didn't know.
We were rooftops.
We were kids. Well, yeah, rooftops got to mention. Yeah, if you wanted to be a bit more Turaki.
Formal.
Turaki.
Yeah,
geez.
A bit more
sort
formal
of
and highfalutin.
Private schoolish.
Yeah, private. That's
Warren
private school
feeling
stuff.
Very special this morning. Being
well, Warrandyte is the Turak of the North, as you well know.
Yeah, so rooftops or flats was what it was going up. So now, rather than toss a coin, in my illustrious career as a field umpire, rather than tossing of the coin, there was
a football field umpire.
Yeah, there was a situation where I put the whistle behind my back.
Guess the hand.
It was a right or left situation.
Whoa.
Which was old school, but especially because of the mud in the middle. Often, if the coin was flipped, it may get lost in the Merri Creek soil. So it was the whistle situation. But I mean, look, I don't know whether it matters. Well, clearly, it doesn't matter because it's. You know?
It doesn't really matter.
No.
I do worry about people like Tim Ludeman, Jimmy Pearson, Alex Carey, these types.
Why do you worry about them?
Well, if we're going with rooftops and flats for the toss of the coin, we could still be going, next year could be automatic wicketkeeper.
Yeah, that's a concern.
Automatic wicketkeeper, that was awesome.
Keepers will have no role.
One bounce, one hand. I love
Soon
that.
Six and out will be coming in. That'll be bad for the Big Bash.
What was your, growing up, playing cricket in the backyard or in our case it was playing in the street, what was the local rules? Did you have any?
Oh, that did were we unique? Have any? Did we have any? Mate, one of the great sets of rules in the history of cricket. This is almost wisdom stuff is what we need to be archiving this as. We played in the garage because it was all weather surface.
And we'd shiny concrete.
Double garage in the burbs in Watsonia. And double garage, shiny concrete. Usually mum's car would be on the right-hand side. So playing through the offside was dangerous because car on the full was out, clearly. So that was a dangerous habit. That's why I'm so strong on the leg side. Because the door into the house was four, which was just a little flick to mid-wicket. That was just a to four. And then the back door out to the backyard, which was the... almost the lap situation, the reverse sweep. Well, not the reverse sweep, the sweep. Very fine sweep it was. That was 10. So we get inside the ball and inside the line. But the petrol can, Dad's petrol can for the mower, was little David Boone at short leg, and he was out as well, which is tough to get a pass. If you're trying to hit the 4 or the 10, David Boone came in to play a lot. So the petrol can was our key one. You can move the can too, wherever you want it, which was important because my brother was strong through cover. So I had a little pad, silly mid off.
Yeah.
And got him a few times there. So the petrol cam was our thing.
What about you, Rama?
We had we played in the driveway.
Dad's going to be had the beat, by the way.
We played in the driveway at, in the front yard, and on the front lawn there was a big tree. So it was a beautiful sort of cover drive, square drive, where the tree sort of sat, depending where we put the wicket. So that was 20, if you hit that.
20?
20.
Oh, that's a bonus.
But it was a beautiful shot. You had to really caress it to sort of get that tree. So we made that 20. Our biggest issue, though, playing as kids is the next-door neighbour, they had a big Rottweiler.
Oh.
Big.
Angry Rottweiler?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was six and sort of game over. Now,
get a new tennis ball. You just need a bucket of balls. That's what
well,
you know,
we dude. Sort of, yeah, that was a little bit difficult. We had to go down and sort of, you know, lift up the drains in the oh, yeah, sort of the street that, yeah. and all that yeah. type of stuff to find some new tennis balls. But yes. So the temptation was, because the Rottweiler used to sort of duck around the side of the house and he couldn't see us sometimes. So if the ball was right near the fence where we used to jump over,
yeah.
it was like, do we take the risk? And we did take the risk a couple of times.
Some real adrenaline kicking in.
And did the Rottweiler come around the corner at a million miles per hour a couple of times. And sort of, I think in my early age, I could have done high jump. No doubt whatsoever. I would just hurdle over
the fence.
The fence at times when that dog was coming around the corner.
It's so. Amazing what happens when you're getting chased by a 100-kilo dog.
Amazing. So that was our automatic wiki. Sometimes we would play automatic first slip as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, you had to do that too. Yeah. It had to be a region on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah, and the stump's height with the rubbish bins as well was important. We used to put a strip of tape.
What did you do?
Oh, what did I do? Didn't take half an hour. Haystack or haystack up or haystack down has come through on the SMS.
That's from a farmer, surely.
Flats up and flats down. Send them through 0416905052. The
flats
terminology
up or flats
you use.
Down.
Yeah.
Flats up or flats down. Okay, yeah, right.
We were at a court where I lived, and we had a fire hydrant in a perfect position to be the stump. It was perfect. But the key for us was more the half-tape tennis ball and the craft that was used in creating the swing, the purchase.
Yeah.
There's also a few different... The Shane Warne ball that came in that you could actually swing and bowl lead cutters with.
Don't
and the Kanga
Shane
cricket
Warne.
Ball. There was a few of those. So it was more a ball thing that we tried to...
You're a tamperer.
No.
You are. Just,
well, it was probably more about... You know, other people trying to find ways of getting me out because it was difficult.
Yeah, it would have been difficult.
We had one hand, one bounce, and two bounces, no hands. So you had to cradle it in your arms or catch it in your legs potentially as well. And these are the sorts of things that took place. Yeah, again, it was more a handicap situation. Try and find ways of getting certain people out.
You've really got to keep the ball on the ground there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
It's no good for it. It's not much fun.
We lived at the top of a hill. And a little bit like you were saying before, if you hit the ball down the offside, it could race off down the hill. It was almost like once it hits those practice rickets, it really races away to the boundary. But it would go down the hill, and if it went past the telegraph pole, it became the responsibility of the batsman to have to go and get the ball. And it would take. Went down a genuine hill.
Yeah.
And often would end up in the drain and we'd have no ball.
So you were, as the batsman, you played a great shot and you're forced to go and chase it.
So it'd be a little bit like you.
It's a poor system.
You were saying before that you'd had to tend to hit the ball on the onside, yes. value for runs, but also you'd stay in, you know, you wouldn't have to run. So there was a lot of hitting across the line when we were playing real cricket on a Saturday, and the excuse was always, but I do it at home, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, and I'm reliving it now with my son. You know, up on the roof last night. You know,
up on the roof?
Well, first thing I picked up Campbell from school, and it was, okay, Dad, I've got some tennis balls up on the roof. Can you please go up on the roof? I don't have anything to play with when I get home. Okay, no worries. Which is exactly what my dad used to do for me. He'd go up on the roof, 13 tennis balls, 2 soccer balls and a football, which was a nice...
Is that a record haul?
Oh, it's been similar. So, and then even like I get out of the car and in the front garden there was about 3 balls. I don't know where they came from. So he's certainly understanding that sort of thing.
Basketball's in the front yard. Always the two neighbours next to our house now throwing tennis balls,
right.
soccer balls back over. Oh. It's nearly embarrassing at
times. It is. I agree.
It's like, sorry, guys.
I've now told if Campbell wants his ball, he's got to go and he's got to
knock
on the door.
Yep.
How much do you want to play, Campbell? How much do you want to play? I'm not going.
We did have, just upon reflection, we did have a, because you play straight drive back over the driveway, over the other side of the road. Mm. If you got to the other side of the road, it was four. Mm. And then you could bowl a fast one from the middle of the driveway. And in the enclosed garage, it was quite intimidating. But we'd have this light pole, and it was just before our side of the road, which was, we call Curtly Ambrose because he's so tall.
Yeah.
And if you hit Curtly on the full, you're out. Like, you had to hit it underneath the garage roof, carry another 12 metres, 15 metres to Curtly and hit him on the full. So you play this cracking straight drive, in the air albeit, and hit Curtly and you're out. And devastation. But the ones that used to come in, the when you hit it for four with a half, the bounce of the garage and the slidey concrete, the shiny concrete,
oh, that's
all worth there. Some spitters coming off that deck.
Yeah.
Right at your scone.
We also had my brother's rules. My brother would play. He's older than me, of course. He'd bat first. I'd bowl at him for hours and hours, finally getting him out. I'm not playing anymore. So I'd chase him when he'd drop the bat, and I'd throw the bat at him, and it'd be odd. It would be odd.
I like this from Georgina. I've been teaching for 50 years, close enough anyway. It's the same thing. And have only ever heard kids say hills or flats. That's a 50-year experience. That's a big sample size.
It is.
That's what that is. Thank you, Georgina, for that. Richie's in Caulfield on the open line, 1-300-652-927. Good morning, Richie.
Yeah, g'day, Half. I think if they're going to go down this toss and the bat thing, maybe they should think about having, facing up five overs of French cricket style and five overs of a bit of tippity and, go down that path.
Tippity. Well, I think tippity's got absolute merit. In fact, in Big Bash, it just about is these days, isn't it? Hit the ball and run. It's almost what
French
it is.
French cricket with French those lap shots that they do now. Let's sort of
imagine facing James Pattinson, French cricket style. I don't think I want to play that game.
No.
You might have to have restrictly run-ups, although Bumrah would still do some damage off two steps.
He would.
If he was playing the French
cricket
style.
Maybe that's what happened. I think actually it is what happened with Bumrah. I stand to be corrected here, but a lot of questions about his run-up was that when he was playing essentially straight cricket,
There was no space behind,
and he came off about five steps, and it's just stayed that way throughout his career.
Thank you for your call. Bill's in Werribee. Good morning, Bill.
How are you, boys?
Going well.
Bring back a lot of memories this morning. Used to play on the road, and any over the gutter on the full was out, so everyone used to play straight.
Yes.
I just wish I could go back 25 years ago and play the ramp shot.
if only we could go back and do what we, play what we know now back then, absolutely. The ramp would have been so handy.
The most remarkable thing about this is what, and how we're talking about it is, we would play every single night without fail. Mm. Like, until now, daylight saving, obviously, you'd play to 8:30 or till mum called you in for dinner. If you drive down any street in Melbourne now, you'd be lucky to see one or two kids playing out in the road, playing cricket or set up. You know, we painted a tennis court on our road out the front of our house.
Yeah, we did the lines.
We
did with chalk.
With chalk,
though.
Yeah.
No, we painted. We got the paint.
That's aggressive painting.
We need permanent.
that's a permit issue.
Well, chalk sort of, if it rains. No, not in Dufton.
Mountains or flats is another one that's come through. I love this one here on the text. This is one of my favourite texts for the year. How about the standard reply of two to come when someone asks how many balls are left in the over?
It was always
that
two to come.
Fantastic text.
And two to come would often still be six.
Yeah, that's right.
You'd still bowl two and then it'd still be two to come. And you get through two sets of that, I reckon, before you hand over the ball. Two to come. How many left? Two to come. Great to have Cameron White with us, of course, one of the big parts of the Victorian cricket team, but also a huge part of the Melbourne Renegades in the Big Bash competition kicking off in a week's time. And it's Melbourne Renegades membership morning on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning to you, Whitey.
Half, how are you?
I'm going very well, thank you. Now, we've got a signed Renegades playing top to give away to one of our listeners through the morning. Also, just a plain Renegades playing top, not signed. And two double-up family memberships, two adults, two kids, throughout the next little while. So stay listening and get yourself involved when you need to if you'd like to win one of those outstanding giveaways from our team and the friends at Melbourne Renegades. Have you moved into White Ball T20 headspace already?
This afternoon.
This afternoon?
Yeah, our first, we've got a practice match, first of a three or four, I think, this afternoon down at the Junction Oval, Renegades v Stars in a practice match. So get stuck into it this Arvo.
Yeah, the second innings, Sheffield Shield practice match, pretty much for Big Bash
on Monday.
Yeah, it didn't go too well for me. Thanks for that. Yeah, we did. We were trying to set up a total there at the on the flat MCG wicket. Unfortunately, was a bit in vain. Couldn't get the result last four wickets. So, yeah, but yeah, a few of the boys had a bit of a slog there in preparation.
Did you hit the ball down leg side?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah. I was just spewing that, yeah, I got it. Got out.
You're slightly disappointed.
Did you nearly whack the stumps? Did you have one of those moments?
Clearly above. Had a swing at them just to make sure I missed. Thank you. Good start, you bet.
Hey, he brought it up, not us. I didn't know anything about it. He brought it up. Mm. But we'll focus on the Shield for a second before we get to the Big Bash, and we'll focus clearly on that for a fair bit. But leaving the halfway mark with the Bush Rangers, or the Victorian cricket team, comfortably on top of the Shield table, when we were chatting pre-season, this wasn't perhaps the expectation. Have we overachieved, or was this the level of play that we have in the team that's just gelled at the same time?
No, I don't think so. I think we've played pretty well, so you always go into the season with high hopes. So I thought we were a bit unlucky, obviously, not to win probably four, if not, you know, five of our first six games, to be honest. We thought we were in a really strong position three games ago now against South Australia, when somehow the MCG flooded, which I've never seen on the last day before. And then obviously we were played up in Queensland, and then probably had the better of, you know, WA for the best part of, well, for the match, I think, in this last game, but unfortunately couldn't get those last four wickets. So, yeah, pretty obviously happy that we're on top of the ladder, but, you know, things could have been better as well.
We've spoken a lot about James Pattinson's bowling in the second innings, and even the first innings, to be honest. It was the first time he sort of being let off the leash. What was your observations at second slip? I know that the ball was flying through there a couple of times off his bowling. Is that as good as you've seen him bowl for a long time? For pace?
I think his pace was definitely up. I think the boy, I didn't play in the Queensland match, but they said the second innings there, he bowled it, you know, closer to 80%, and the boys said, well, if that was 100, if he's got 100%, he's going to bowl 180 kilometres an hour. So, but yeah, I think he's definitely, you know, the confidence is probably coming back in his body. I think he's pulling up pretty well from his spells and from the day's play. So definitely, I think he let himself go a bit in this game, just gone. So that's really good to see. It's encouraging that he's pulling up well. He's not sore or anything. So I think his rhythm, he's still probably fighting his rhythm and things like that. But he's still, you know, the pace is there, which is the main thing. You know, he's got the skill, and that rhythm will come once he's played a couple more games.
And the energy, the body language.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm interested for you, as played a lot of cricket, and a bit of criticism around the Australian team is that they are a bit of an introverted bowling group. That what he does to create the excitement in the match and how important that is.
Yeah, well, some of the boys are starting to call him the animal. So,
George the Animal Steel.
Yeah, no, he's sort of, you know, he's very competitive. The whole family is a bit loose as well. So, you know that.
Correct.
You know, the Doveton connection out there. That's right.
Your boys, Rama.
So, yeah, you know, he's got that fire, that passion, that competitiveness to really get involved in the game, and that's just his personality. So, as you mentioned, I heard earlier about Scott Boland talking about him, people feed off that energy that, you know, when you're playing alongside him. He transfers that into his batting as well. He's so competitive and hates giving away his wicket as well. So he's just such a great person to play cricket with. You know, he gives you 100% all the time, combined with that sort of energy and, you know, fear factor for the opposition as well. They're probably a little bit scary over him. I wouldn't want to say anything to him either.
Hey, how was Travis Dean as captain? How much assistance did you have to give him through the game?
Not much. I think Travis probably had a bit of introduction pre-season to captaincy. So I think he took the role, you know, and just went with it, really, I think. He batted really well in the second innings, which was good for him as well. He was probably needing a few runs, so that was good for his confidence. And I thought he led well, and tactically he was really good. I think he's done a bit for that for his club side, Footscray. So, yeah, he's going pretty well and fitted into that role, no worries.
Beautiful. That's good stuff. What about the Bukowski comeback? How did he come into the game? Was he normal in terms of the way he's carrying on or behaving?
Yeah, we just had to control Adam up in the stands. I've heard him talk about Will's batting a fair bit over the last couple of days. So I know Adam gets excited about Will's batting, like the rest of us do. But no, he fitted back in. I think he was a little bit edgy in the first innings. Probably played it's hard to say for a 20-year-old, a very Will Bukowski shot, actually. But settled back down second innings, and you know, just peeled off 70 there. So and barely raised a sweat, really, I think. So probably if we weren't declaring, he'd probably be still batting now, I'd say. So you just saw more of what he is capable of and he will continue to do over and hopefully throughout a long career for him. So just batted and kept the ball on the ground and just played the ball on its merits. I know it's an old school thing, but that's exactly what he does. He just watches every ball, plays it, hits it where it should be. If it's a leave, he leaves it. If it's a cut, he cuts it. It's just, you just bat. So he's a very proper batsman and a very good one at that.
I was reading a comment yesterday from Crash Craddock in response to the first test performance by the Australian batsman. He said this: the price of Australia's big bash boom is that Australia has missed a generation of test batsmen. Now, I thought about that when he wrote it, and I read it, I thought, does that make sense or not? Because when you look at India, I mean, you look at guys like Pujara and well, half the team, really, they are capable of being really good test batsmen, and the IPL has been the biggest boom in changing cricket in the last 20 years. So why would they have generations of players that are capable of getting to test cricket and batting and being stars, and we don't seem to, and we have that excuse coming out?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But interestingly, I know we're about to touch on the big bash, but I think Will might have been just, you know, the Melbourne Stars have had a couple of injuries this week, and I think Will might have been asked to, you know, jump onto their list. And I think he said, I think he's knocked it back. So I think he just wants to concentrate on the four-day sort of side of his game. Obviously, he's had a few sort of issues as well, so he just wants a breather and just to make sure he's right for the Sheffield Shield season. But, I don't really know. Does someone like Pujara, I don't even know, I haven't played in the IPL the last couple of years, does he actually play in the IPL? I'm pretty sure he doesn't.
They've got
about 20 billion people to pick from over there as well.
I understand that. But my question is it a coach, the way we're coaching young players?
Oh, I couldn't imagine so. No, I think our coaching is, you know, it's pretty good around the country. I think it's just maybe the style of player that we produce these days. I'm not really sure, but Will's definitely in the mould of a more, you know, your traditional sort of player. But thinking around the country, he's probably, you know, there's not many of his type in the younger brigade, that's for sure.
I think he just could be a once-in-a-generation player that is just something a bit special. He's an outlier to everyone else with how he plays at the age he does. And I had a chat to Wayne Clark, who is the former coach of Western Australia, who hadn't seen him live before. When he made the 200, he didn't see the game. And he just couldn't believe it. He just wanted to keep talking about him all the time, you know, because he just had never seen someone so young play the way he does. And it's a little bit like, you know, what Cam said, that it's not, you don't just sit there and go, wow, because of the shots he plays. You go, wow, because of the time he has and the way he just hits every ball the way it should be hit. And these placement, keeping the ball on the ground, all those sorts of things. His pull shot, if there's two men out but back behind square, he pulls it in front of square. Just common sense sort of cricket. I can't think of a player to compare him with other than Brad Hodge from a Victorian perspective in 20 years of having the time that he has and just no flowery backlift or no extravagant shots. It just plays normal cricket shots really well.
We better jump in, Rammer, because it's getting exciting.
I told you, you got to keep an eye on.
Fair man crush.
Well, that's just what he does. It's exciting. That's okay.
I think the way with Will, I think I've probably said it on this show before. I think if you went and saw him bat, you couldn't tell whether he was on naught or 250. Yeah. He will just play the same way. He hates getting out. He refuses to hit the ball in the air because he just knows that it'll increase the chances of him getting out. So if he's on zero or 250, he'll bat the same way. A bowler has to get him out. He's not like a, you know, some players, myself included, you know, you might get 50 or if you're lucky enough, 100, you know, you think, right, I can probably start to take a few risks now, you know, expand my game. No, Will will just, you've got to get him out. Like, it's just classic sort of test match sort of stuff.
The last one before we take the break and narrow in on the Renegades, you got 100 yourself in the last game and batted extremely well, except for when you're on 72.
What did you do on 72?
He was on 72 for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. Whose fault was that?
Not mine. No. Yours. It was just the way it was.
It's an unusual little sidebar.
But how do you feel your batting going into the Big Bash season, considering what you've done so far in the Shield and through the JLT Cup?
Yeah, happy with the way my game's gone this year. Feel as though it's in a good place, but been very similar sort of mindset for me over the last couple of years. So Big Bash, it's totally sort of different. You need a bit of luck. You need, you know, you've obviously got to take a lot of risk. The complete opposite to Will Pekoski's batting, I guess. Hopefully get off to a good start in the Big Bash and then take a little bit of pressure off. But in terms of 4-day cricket and obviously through the 1 days, mindset's been good. Mind's been clear. So that's the most important thing for me, translated into a few runs.
We were talking before, Whitey, about your squad and the blow to the squad with the absence of Aaron Finch and Marcus Harris of recent times, who's back into the into the national spotlight. What do you do about that?
Yeah, good question.
You're opening now.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm happy up the top of the order there. But, yeah, obviously great news for Aaron Finch and Marcus Harris to be in the test squad. So that's not so good news for the Renegades, obviously. But, you know, I've got a couple other little worries there as well. I know Bo Webster, we played a Sheffield Shield game down in Tassie a couple of weeks ago, and Bo hurt his knee. So I'm hoping that he's going to be okay for us as well, because at times when he played last year, he did a really good job, and I think he can be an important player. But yeah, it's just it'll be the makeup and to see how we can sort of put our list together. I think, you know, our bowling lineup, however we sort of decide, is pretty settled there. But obviously with Marcus and Aaron out, you know, just the top of the order there, just be up to obviously Andrew and the, you know, to decide Andrew McDonald, that is the coach, on how we sort of structure up there at the top of the order.
So can you bring people in? Can you bring other players in? What's the rulings
the rules
on?
Work there?
No, I'm not sure whether you can, because I mean that's the issue with Nick Maddison at the moment, because he's an Australian player. But I'm saying that they can't just go and replace him. They've actually got I think they've got some supplementary list or something that they can potentially bring someone in from, but they can't.
Injured players you definitely can, obviously, but I'm not totally sure on the ruling.
Really, national duties.
Andrew might be listening. He might be able to text him.
Yeah, I think you can only replace international players. So, like, Butler and Morgan are playing for Sydney Thunder, but they're only playing half the tournament, so they've got to find players to replace for the second half.
Yep.
Whereas when you're, you know, if you're playing for Australia, well, that's just bad luck. You've got to have a deep squad to cover for it. Right. Marcus Harris is an interesting one because he got dropped a couple of times to the Renegades through the last couple of years. So obviously he's playing better now, but he has been a bit hit and miss for the Renegades. Finch is the one they'll clearly miss.
Yes, at the top of the order.
But they've got Tim Ludeman at the top.
Well, you've anointed him as the opener to be. The White Ludeman combination looks all right to me at the top of the order.
Well, what about the bowlers? Can you play the three spinners?
Yeah, that'll be one thing, especially maybe at Etihad, that we'll have to decide on. I did write down a very quick lineup that I absolutely guess for the Renegades, and I heard Adam had me opening, so I stuck myself in an opening. Ludeman up there with him. I had Mackenzie Harvey. I was looking for I put him at number three.
How's he going?
He's also fighting a bit of a shoulder injury as well at the moment, but I'm hoping, I know he started batting, I think, last week, so I'm hoping he's right for the start of the tournament. Tom Cooper at four, Daniel Christian five, Wildermuth six, Bo Webster seven, Mohammad Nabi eight, and then I'm skipping a spot here. I've got Kane Richardson at 10 and Shinwari at 11. Then it was the decision whether we went the extra fast bowler or John Holland in there at 9 as well. So obviously that 9, 10, 11, not sure who they'll be tossing them up to see what order they bat in. But that'll be just the makeup of our, an absolute guess at the makeup of our team. But it'll be a balance between how many quicks. We've got a couple all-rounders in the middle there. Obviously, Wildermuth and Dan Christian bowl. Tom Cooper bowls a bit there at number 4. So there's a fair few bowling options there already. Nabi, obviously, as the overseas, you know, mixture of whether we go with the extra spinner, which I think we probably will.
Greg Miller's leading the charge at the Sandown Greyhounds. He's the CEO there. He's been good enough to join us in studio this morning. Good morning to you, Greg.
Daniel, and thanks for having me in.
Pleasure. Great to have you in. Now, I must admit, I don't know too much about this draft that's coming up on the weekend. Can you explain more about the concept of what's happening in the world of greyhounds?
Well, it's a new idea. I guess I've taken some of my football experience days and brought it into the greyhound racing. So it's virtually exactly the same. We've got 30 draft prospects, and in this case, they're young greyhound pups, the best bred pups we could find in Australia. None of them have raced. They're all young pups, just between the ages of 6 weeks and 11 months. And then we've gone out and found or created 10 teams. And one of those teams is Team RSN.
Yes.
Led by James Vandermat. And this is, you know, Whitey's been on to me. He said, come on, get a team. So you got a team. And James will go to the draft on Sunday morning on Sky Channel. Yep. And he'll have three choices in the draft in an order we've created.
Do we get first pick, Greg? This is very important.
I can't tell you who's going to get first
pick. We don't want first pick. That would mean that we weren't very good.
No one's very good at the moment. Draft. It's a first draft, mate.
Yeah, but we don't want first pick because James will pick sort of diamonds in the rough.
No, no, we want the best dogs. Right. We don't want diamonds.
Yeah, we want the fast dog.
Now, we have one worry with James. It's his engagement party the night before.
Oh!
So I've got him coming in on an Uber that night straight from Warrandyte. I'm not going to leave any stone unturned to make sure he's there on time. So he'll be there fresh, I hope. And he's done his homework beforehand, and he'll have these 30 pups to choose from. And as he's choosing his pups and getting his team together, three dogs, you can be online, which is 2018draft.com.au.
Yep.
2018draft.com.au, and you can join the team. You can put an application, a non-binding expression of interest in, and the first 20 that are in, we send them a prospectus, we send them all the details, and if they want to pay their money, which is about $2,550, they get a 5% share in the three dogs.
Right.
So it's just all live. It's happening Sunday morning, and if you're ever interested in getting a Sydney together and buying into a greyhound pup, all I can tell you is they're the best bred pups in Australia. They've been reared at the best places, and we've got teams like Team Britain. We've got all the best trainers from around Australia involved, and so it's a cheap entry point in terms of racing. There's no ongoing training fees with greyhound racing in this case with our syndicates. So you put your $2,550 in, and we find a fan of Bale or another champion, well, and yeah, off we go. Look, it doesn't always work that way, as we know, but what we've done is at least assisted some of the variables by getting best bred, best rearing, and best trainers.
So essentially, you've got a situation where for under $1,000, you're going to get a greyhound. Because you get three, two and a half.
So, yeah, you get a 5% share. That's right.
So it gets yourself a relatively cheap way of getting involved in racing greyhounds. And as you said, there's no ongoing cost. So this is one of the great keys to it, is that you sit back and hopefully enjoy the winnings.
Well, you can never guarantee it, but at least we've done a lot of the hard work behind the scenes. And this sort of way of getting involved is pretty simple. You just got to make sure you're ready to go on your laptops, or your devices. And, you can buy in or you can put your application. This is all done through a financial services license, so it's all been done absolutely correctly. Contracts will be in place, and, so you've got 72 hours to accept the offer that we put to you. And if you accept that offer, you're in. Yep.
I know it's taken you a long time to get to this point. It's been, a lot of work behind the scenes, but it is all about trying to make this sport easier to get involved in and get more people involved in it.
Yeah, look, the registry part is a lot of work. Yeah, you've got to make sure ASIC approves everything you do. So we've actually working with a company called Primary Securities, a fantastic organisation who took us on board and who assisted us the last 6 months. So it's been fantastic. But now we're in a situation of offering something and expanding it, because we want all the syndication companies around Australia to, if they want to grow, to piggyback with us and grow the sport. This is the best way to grow the sport, is get people involved through ownership. And the numbers game is really important in our sport. And the interest in betting on our sport's never been stronger. And there's also an opportunity now to be involved in a pretty simple process.
That's great. And Team RSN, I've just had a look at the website at 2018draft.com.au, like you mentioned before, the National Greyhound Draft. We've got the best three trainers in the history of greyhound training, as far as I'm concerned. Matt Lanigan. Brendan Purcell and Kate Gorman. They're our three trainers for our dogs.
That's right.
So that's Team RSN. Now, James Vandermeer, as you said, will be driving the bus for us on Sunday morning. Hopefully not driving the porcelain bus after a big night. at his engagement.
Oh, no.
But that's what's going to be happening. So if you want to get involved with that, go to the website and be a part of it, 2018draft.com.au. When you first floated this suggestion, Greg, what sort of feedback did you get from the industry?
I guess there was some trepidation. Like some of the other syndicators think, but what are you trying to do to us? You're taking us over. No, we're just trying to regulate. We're trying to make sure everything's compliant so we can get bigger.
Yep. Yeah,
that's what you've got to do in this new age. When we want to help the other syndicators become compliant if they want to. They can stay below the line and do what they're doing with families and everything. And that's not a problem. But if you want to grow, you've got to do it right. So we've actually done it right. With the help of Jess Bolneric from Spolly Syndications, we got together and we've done this, and so it's a correct path to grow the sport. So, there's a little bit of concern. But look, now, I've just been talking to the boys behind the scene, the interest and the website traffic and the Facebook traffic, whatever that means, it's all... they tell me this morning, I get all these charts sent to me, I don't know what they mean, but they're looking fantastic. It's gone viral, I reckon. Is that the word?
They're viral, that's right. That's the terminology for the crazy kids these days.
So who own the pups beforehand?
Your breeders. They're out in the marketplace. And Georgie Ferrugia, Georgie's a great breeder and grand enthusiast. And he RSN's own again. Yeah. He's on RSN every week. Georgie, we engaged George. He went out in the marketplace and he went from place to place to place. All the best breeders. And he understands the breeding and he's bought the best. So he spent 8-9 months doing this behind the scenes. Yeah.
There's some all the details about the horses. The dogs are on the website. You go through the draft prospects.
Yeah.
There's a couple.
Is Cal Toomey looking through the dogs?
Cal Toomey from
Sammy Landsberger.
I'm not sure who's looking through them, but you get a fair bit of information about all of the dogs as part of the litters there for on Sunday for the draft. It's fantastic. It's really good. Yeah. As you said, and you go through the names, like Basha Bales leading, leading Sire, Black Magic Goble.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole host of Premier Fantasy pups in there as well. So some really well-bred Fernando Bales, you said. It's really well-bred. It's been I imagine it's been a fairly tough logistical exercise to put it all together, though.
Yeah. We've got a good team at Sandown, and with George and Jess's help, we've got a good team working on it. And everyone's excited about it. Something new, and it's innovative, and it'll get people talking. It's talkability, which is really important in our industry, and we're getting it. And I always sense support's been fantastic. You know, Adam said to me 6 months ago, I said, just wait, Adam, wait. And we're now come to the time, Adam. So you'll have a team to promote over the next few years, starting on Sunday.
Yeah, it's exciting. And what about the naming of the dogs?
Thanks for asking that question, because the 20 people who get involved get to name the dog, and of course Breakfast Club's going to be on the agenda.
You would think so.
I would think so. However, there's a 21st person. If you want to own the dog at the end of its career, on the website there's a spot there to own the dog. So if you want to be a part of the whole syndication, you've got no money in your pocket, but you want to own the dog when it finishes racing, put your name down, you'll be involved with all the syndicate things that happen during the next couple of years. You'll get all the information about where it races and invited to everything. And when the dog finishes its racing career, you take it home. So you're the 21st owner, and you get to be part of the naming rights as well.
That's good. That's good.
We've covered everything.
You have covered everything. I was just going... I will reference it again, 2018draft.com.au. It's a terrific website, and as you said, Greg, you've covered everything, and more importantly, from a consumer's perspective, all the information is very, very clear and easy to read and understand on the website.
Yeah, thank you. And also, one thing, I just want to thank all the trainers that have got involved and the owners. They've had to put $5,000 in each. So they've just handed $5,000, because I wanted to find out that they were really feeding about the industry. If the owners and trainers don't get involved in the industry, we haven't got an industry. So they've got to drive it, and they are. And I applaud every one of these, all these trainers, Lucia, Ada, and the owners who have put their money in and supporting what we're doing.
You mentioned before that the betting on the greyhounds has never been higher.
Yep.
I imagine 2 years ago when the scandal hit that there's a lot of question marks about the viability and the future of the whole industry.
Yep.
Are you surprised at how strongly it's rebounded?
Well, it's been a great credit to GRV, I've got to say. They got their government part right, the part they had to get right, they got right. And they've worked very hard on welfare, and they've got that right. They've turned the corner. The whole thing had to change, and it did, all for the better. And now while they're doing their part with the regulatory side, it's up to the clubs and the owners and trainers to drive the industry forward, and that's what seems to be happening. So, yeah, no, look, the betting's just gone up and up and up. The young generation, this is who we're appealing to with the draft. They love this. They love grand racing because they get their money back within, you know, a few seconds.
Yep.
Within 30 seconds. There's no bloody correct weights or any of that rubbish. And off they go again. And grand racing's on all the time. And it's pretty easy to follow a colour or follow a dog or follow a trainer.
Let's talk some hoops now on The Breakfast Club. It was a pretty disastrous weekend for the Melbourne United group boys, because back-to-back losses to Brisbane, one away and then one at home on Monday night. Still sees them second on the table, but I reckon it might just dent the conference a bit. Let's find out what Josh Boone thinks about all that, one of the stars of the show for United. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
We're going all right, buddy. How is the conference after the weekend? Because I imagine it would have been quite disappointing to lose the series, so to speak, to Brisbane in the last week or so.
Yeah. It was obviously a tough weekend. They came out and they had a great game plan for us. You know, they were doubling Casper everywhere. They were throwing a lot of junk defenses at us, which is, you know, kind of what they're known for and what Andre's teams are known for over the course of the years. But they really executed their game plan well, took us out of what we wanted to do, and that was why they were able to beat us twice in a row.
Josh, the small ball lineup is seemed what caused the most problems for you guys, where you really, you know, you fell into that trap of yourself and Alex being off the court and going with a small ball lineup. How did you feel about that personally?
Well, you know, Dean made a change later in the game to go small in the fourth quarter and then to try and speed up the tempo a little bit. We needed to get points, and that was how he felt that we were going to be best equipped to try and score the most amount of points, because we were down pretty good at that point. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. But, you know, I have some great faith in our small ball lineup. It's worked over the course of the year. We saw it work really well against Sydney at times. So, you know, we have a lot of guys that can come in and play those different positions. DJ can play probably four different positions on the court. Dave Barlow can play three different positions. So, you know, it's helpful when you have those guys that can do it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
It's such a long season, Josh. How hard is it to stay up the whole time? We saw last year you sort of go through fluctuations through the year. You're playing so well early in the season. Is it just one of those things that it's the natural sort of course of the year?
I mean, sometimes it can be a little bit difficult, but honestly, the season here is not very long. It's only 28 games. It's only a few months. I think it's like 4 or 5 months, something like that. So it really shouldn't be an excuse for teams not to be able to stay up the whole time. You know, you see the best teams in this league can do that consistently. And, you know, you see Perth doing that right now. And there's a reason why they're number one in the table, because they're up for every game. They went through a pretty long spell here without their best player and still managed to get through it and stay atop the table. So that speaks volumes to them. So, you know, we're the defending champs, but right now, obviously, they're the team that everybody's trying to beat, and that's who we have coming in this coming weekend. So it's a great opportunity for us to really bounce back and show that, you know, we belong at the top of that table as well.
Which we're all looking forward to seeing, absolutely. And just on what you said before, I was interested to talk more about the way that they doubled Casper and try to throw some junk defenses at you. That's obviously going to be a tactic now for other clubs to try and limit the influence that the Casper and some of the big guns have for Melbourne United. Does it give you a chance to really review that strongly and come up with new systems to make sure you can counter that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think we knew going in that was going to be the case, and I think we dealt with it much better in the first game because they did do it on Saturday, I believe, in Brisbane. They did it a bunch there, and they did it again here on Monday. You know, we missed a lot of pretty easy shots. We missed a lot of shots at the rim. We missed a lot of putbacks. And in turn, they also, you know, defended us well and forced us into some tough ones too. But, you know, we've got a week here to make some adjustments to really work hard on the practice floor, and that's what we're going to do.
The wildcard playoffs, the Australian Open, were getting underway yesterday, and it's great to have Alan Perez on the line with us this morning, who had a good result yesterday and is getting ready for her second match of the tournament. She joins us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Alan.
Hi, good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Thanks for being a part of the program. Now, how big a thing would it be to qualify? How significant is this moment or opportunity for you to get a qualifying spot for the Australian Open?
Yeah, it'd be unreal. It'd be my first main draw of the Australian Open, so that's obviously a huge goal of mine. I've done it before once at the US Open playoff, and I was able to play there, and it was an unreal experience, so I'd love the opportunity to be able to do that again.
So in the build-up to this, with that on the line and how important it is to you, what sort of preparation have you done in the build-up to the qualifiers?
Well, after about a month ago, I took a bit of a break for 10 days just to recoup and just have a little time away from the tennis court and have some fun. But yeah, since then I've come back, just been training. Actually had a few knee ulcers, so it's probably set me back a little more than I'd like. I've actually changed weight in my racket too, so just a few changes to kind of prepare for the Australian Open summer with bigger picture in mind. But yeah, just been training hard and having a few match play leading into the tournament and just getting ready to
So have you gone heavier or lighter with your racket?
I've gone heavier, yeah.
And tell us what that does. For those that don't know the intricacies of the weight distribution, how it affects you, any given performance, what does it do for you, the heavier racket?
Yeah, so I've added a little bit heavier in the head. So it allows me to keep my racket more on the line of the ball a bit better. Gives me a bit more control. My racket to begin with was pretty light. So I probably gain a little bit more power and control, but lose a little bit of spin. And for me, I guess it helps me with my return game and volleys, just staying on the line of the ball. And, yeah.
So, Alan, when we look through this year for you, you've been on tour now for sort of 5 or 6 years, but it does look like this has been your big breakthrough year. What sort of happened differently to get yourself in a position where you're now in the top 200 in the world?
Yeah, well, when I was 18, I made the decision to go to college. So I've been playing college tennis the past 3 years. And it's really tough to play much of a pro tournament schedule when you're at college. they're committed pretty much the whole year. You can only play in their summer, so June, July, and a little bit of August. So it's pretty hard to maintain a good ranking there. But since leaving last year in April, I mean, I have a full year on the tour now, a year and a half, I suppose. And yeah, I've just been able to build on my ranking, get valuable experience, play these girls day in, day out, and just get to know my way around the pro tour a bit better.
Yeah, so it's interesting about, I wanted to ask you about the college situation, because obviously the Americans do it, you know, they all do it pretty much. But if you had your time again, would you still do it, or would have you done it differently? Because not all Australians go through the college system in America.
Yeah, I think it's becoming more of a better option for players to take now. I would definitely still take that pathway, and I definitely recommend a lot of other players take that pathway. For me, it allowed me to develop my tennis a little more, learn to compete. I mean, I've got the backup education now. If tennis doesn't go well for me, or, you know, you never know when if something's going to happen injury-wise. And I'm very injury-prone, so having that backup and, you know, building those friends and over there and having a family whenever I go back, it's an amazing thing to have. So I definitely value the experience in doing that.
The Kale name is one of the most important at the Port Adelaide Football Club. It looks like the allegiance and the lineage will continue for another generation, with Darren becoming a board member of Port Adelaide late last week. He's back home and he's hanging around with the club that he loves. He joins us on the Breakfast Club this morning. Darren, good morning.
Good morning, boys.
Great to have you on. Congratulations on the appointment. We know you're taking some time off from tennis coaching. Was this always in the back of the mind to get home and have more of an influence and more of an impact with Port Adelaide?
To be honest, not really. I did speak to Koshy a few years ago across from New York, and he did sort of throw the question out there about getting involved with the club at a board level. I've never been on a board before, so the question was a little bit intimidating, but as it worked out, my boy's doing year 12 next year, and the year after he would love to go across to a US college and play some tennis, so next year's a pretty big year for him. So it just coincided with that, with taking a year off coaching, and the time seemed to be right to jump on the board and see if I can give back something back to the club that I love.
And Darren, you talk about being on the board. You've always been so hands-on, obviously, with any of the athletes that you have coached. Are you going to have any involvement with the playing list? Particularly, I think, obviously, you being a coach of elite athletes for so long, in that mental side of the game?
Look, I don't think so. I think there's a strong line that separates the people on the board to the coaching list and also the playing list. So there's a fine line there that you shouldn't cross over. So I think it's really a bit of a look-and-see period for me, especially the first 6 months or so, to see how the boardroom works. I do a little bit of that anyway. Over the last 5 or 10 years, I've done a little bit of mentoring with the players from Port Adelaide. I actually had Brad Ebert get on the phone to Andre Agassi a few years ago, and Andre spoke to him for a couple of years. So I've tried to use my tennis contacts to help a few of the players along the way. I would always continue to do that if I was asked, but I think you have to respect the line between the board and the coaching list.
Tell us about the link with Port Adelaide, Darren. Obviously, the Kale name is just so famously linked with the club. Yeah. But what about yourself personally?
Well, I'm not that linked. I was a little kid running around in nappies when my dad was coaching and playing there, and my uncle Darrell used to play there as well. And I was the guy that used to hang out the back with his trunk open, the boot of his car open, as he kicked the balls over the fence, and he used to throw the balls in his boot of his car so he could come up and store them back at his house. So I used to run around that club as a kid. I was actually born on grand final day, believe it or not, in 1965, and my dad played for Port Adelaide against Sturt. So there's a bit of history there. We were grown up with black and white in our blood. It's been a remarkable club, and certainly something that I've really built my coaching and playing career on, the history and the heritage that the club had, and a lot of the lessons that my dad sort of taught the guys over the years, is certainly the way that I coach my tennis players these days. So the club itself is in our family. It always has been, and with Dad's history at Port Adelaide, and also he spent a couple of years across at Collingwood, which I thought was amazing as well, to get a look at the VFL. He came back and then coached Port Adelaide again after that. I do remember the only time I've cried at a sporting event was when I was about 10 or 11 years of age in 76, when Port lost to Sturt. It was my dad's first grand final as a coach for Port Adelaide, and back then we were expected to win. I do remember that night, actually. He got the VHS tape and he disappeared for a couple of hours. And that night he was in locked himself in a room and he was watching the tape of the match. And I went in there as a 10-year-old. I said, what the hell are you doing? And he said, I'm just making sure this never happens again. And so, you know, great lessons to be learned as a youngster growing up in that family for sure.
I mean, he must have been a good review. He went on to win 10.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I don't think he lost another grand final, actually, so it worked out pretty well. But he had some good teams back in those days.
So the black and white and the, you know, prison bar jumper of Port Adelaide obviously was the jumper that your dad would have worn and coached with when in his time. Yep. The teal yep. now, how does the teal sit with you?
It's okay. It's a new heritage, a new era, a new history for the club. I think that the new generation coming through now for the last 20 years, that's what they've grown up with. And in another 20 years or so, it'll be even more relevant to the generations growing up. So I have no problem with that. You know, I think that there's a place for Port Adelaide as a club. And I'm just speaking as a fan here, certainly not as a board member because I haven't started. But I think there's a place every now and then to bring the heritage back and wear the old Guernsey. But I don't think it's a regular thing. And I think the two jumpers both will create an enormous amount of history in the black and white bars jersey always has. And it's time for the black, white and teal to do the same thing.
You've said that you'll take some time off from your tennis coaching to spend some more time with your family. You've had such great success recently, of course, with Simona Halep, who won the French Open in June. How difficult is it to walk away when you're so closely connected and you live with these people day in, day out?
Yeah, tough. Yeah, I've got to admit, it's going to get tougher as well as the Aussie Open comes along. And you know, I've already seen all these players doing their pre-seasons and getting ready for the Aussie summer. So definitely extremely difficult because, as you guys know, the next best thing to playing is actually coaching. And I've been really lucky over the last 20 years. I've had three great players that I've worked individually with, in Leighton, Andre, and now Simona for the last 4 years. So to walk away from that is a difficult thing, but obviously being on the road 35 weeks a year for the last 20 years, it is tough on the family as well. We've made a lot of sacrifices in that, and I have a great wife that has put up with me, and certainly time, especially next year, to make sure that Benjamin, my boy, gets the best opportunity to go off to a US college, and then we'll see what happens in 12 months.
Well, I was going to ask that, Darren. You're away 35 weeks of the year. When do you think you'll get bored at home next year?
In a month, more than likely. That's not really the question. It's when my wife will get bored of me being at home. So that's more the question. I dare say in a couple of months, she's going, okay, enough. Go, come on, get out of here.
Hey, we spoke to you when Simona won the French Open. I must confess, one of the best interviews we've had at any point in the year because you were so insightful in what you said about Simona. When you look back at the three that you coached, who are you most proud of in being able to get the best out of them? Or is that too difficult?
Yeah, well, a little bit, only because they are three different stages of their careers. And Leighton was a sponge, and there's only one Leighton Hewitt, and he was quite polarizing, as everybody knows, as a youngster. And I worked with him from 12 years of age through to 21. So to see a young fella from Adelaide, Australia, do exactly what he did on the tour and go to number one in the world and win the US Open, you know, I was eyes wide open most of that time. And it was my first coaching gig as well. So for me, it was a great learning experience. And then a venture across to one of the greatest players of all time. And I have 1,000 stories about Andre and what his life was like and how great he is and what he's done for charitable organisations since he's retired playing. He's an amazing man. But I got to say, the work the last 3 years with Simona has been the most emotional. I think that seeing where she's from, her parents don't speak a word in English, so we kind of communicate via sign language with her mum and dad. And just seeing the struggles that she's had, the emotional struggles, the ups and downs, the kicks to the stomach that she's had, being so close to winning majors and not quite getting there, even before I came along, and knowing the person that she is, and maybe being female a little bit as well, made a big difference to that, just wanting it so badly for her. So, yeah, I can't remember what I said in that interview, but I was probably pretty emotional because it meant a lot to me and certainly meant a lot to her. And that moment when she won that Roland Garros trophy will be maybe my best and most cherished tennis memory for sure.
Yeah, I think the thing that stood out was just the way you talked about how to almost daring her to go out and win it I just think the stuff you said that day was fantastic. I know we got a great reaction from our listeners as well.
It was that good, Darren. We're going to play it in our summer series when we're on holidays.
Actually, I do remember that because I think I mentioned that I took a different tack, right?
Yes,
right,
yes.
The final. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that was true. And a lot of the time she was the type of player that wanted me to take the pressure off her before she went on and played. So I did that a little bit, but before the final, and I threw all the pressure on her shoulders and gave her the big spiel about this is it, this is the time. And maybe it's never going to happen again, and you have to go out there and really go after this like it's your final chance. And she did that. She took the challenge. She was great emotionally on the court. Over the years, it's been well documented that we've had a little bit of problems with her attitude on the court, and I actually left her about a year and a half ago to see if I could try to fix her or shock her into fixing that attitude. And by coincidence, that match she played against Sloane Stephens, she was down a set and a break, was the only match, I think, in the whole 4 years that I've been with her where she didn't look up to me and say one word. She basically just played tennis. So I was really proud of the way she handled that pressure.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.